The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're listening to the Fade to Gray Network.
We invite people
of all backgrounds
to share their stories.
Their nuanced conversations
and forward thinking.
And not taking ourselves too seriously.
Everyone's story matters.
Every voice is important.
Life is polarizing.
But not everything is black and white.
Come join us
as we fade to gray.
Yes, yes. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Fade to Gray. It's Omar here, and I get to introduce one of the first episodes of 2020 that isn't the health series. And wow, what a beginning of 2020 it has been. Not even a week into it, and Australia is on fire, and there's threats and rumors of World War III. Actually, that's what we're getting into today in this conversation. I've recently reconnected with an old buddy of mine who's working in intelligence in the military, and I thought it would be appropriate to have him on and kind of discuss the climate and what's going on in the world today. So here we go. Yo, Andy, kick that music, boy.
I hear you get your news from CNN.
All these other fuckers watching Fox News again.
Yo, Chris, don't they know that that shit is whack?
Hell yeah, Andy, it ain't some white and black.
FTG fan, bam, we found another way.
There's some noobs, motherfucker, on Fade to Gray.
What is up, ladies and gentlemen of Fade to Gray? It is the news for noobs, and oh my God, it is the end of the world as we know it. Yes, indeed, and I feel fine. We've got World War III. I mean, it's a brand new year, right? 2020, and we've already got World War III at the helm.
I hope not.
No, there's no way. So, you know, we thought as news for noobs, it would be important to go ahead and get that information out there for you, because I know that you don't listen to any of those crazy idiots over there at CNN or, you know, Fox News. You want to stick with the actual truth right here on the news for noobs. So They've made the right decision. Super excited. We have a special guest on today, actually one of Omar's old friends. And Omar, do you want to tell us a little bit about our guest today?
Sure, man. I am so excited to have my buddy Ash on today. It's not his real name, but it's okay. I haven't seen this dude in like over a decade. Would you say that's correct, Ash?
Yeah, it's about right.
And we met out in California at a summer camp. And Ash was a dancer and an artist of types when I met him. Mm. And we didn't speak in over a decade, reconnected about a month ago, come to find out that he is now in the military. And not only is he in the military, he's in counterterrorism. And I was like, wow, that's a change. To go from, you know, liberal California dude to, you know, straight up working for the man. So we talked a little bit about that. And obviously with the climate and stuff going on in the news right now, I thought it would be very relevant to have him on. So, Ash, I really appreciate you coming on. And obviously, you can't tell us everything, but the nature of your job. But just thank you for, you know, doing this. This is important. So, I appreciate it.
Pleasure. It's a pleasure. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Is this something that you do often, even in your personal life? You know, try and be a resource for people who have questions about the world at large, or at least from your perspective and how you see it?
Actually, yes. Kind of like we were talking about in our preamble, and we'll become apparent in the recording. There's a ton of things I can't say, and I'm you know, pretty good about that. But what I can say, I am pretty open with people, because like I said to you guys earlier, education is wildly important. If I have to be honest, it's a big part of why I joined. It was just a matter of being a sort of searcher of knowledge, and not to sound too out there, but sort of truth. And there's a point at which I realized in the country, we have a lot of people who their beliefs stem from predisposed biases and isms they believe in, whether they fully accept it or fully aware of it or not. And so they, you know, are inclined to listen to a CNN or a Fox News or a Mother Jones or a Breitbart without realizing that they will decide what they believe before it's told them. And when they, you know, obvious stuff, we all know this, they'll get stuck in an echo chamber, reject anything that doesn't support the worldview. So seeing that, I finally decided, you know what, I'm gonna put my money where my mouth is, and I want a front row seat to history. I want to know what's, if I'm wrong, jump in feet first. And it's been absolutely the right decision, and I love my job, to be honest. It's obviously hard work, but it's the right decision for me. And to answer your question, yeah, I take that knowledge, and that's exactly what I wanted. And I feel like I have a better understanding of the world, and I try to help others have that as much as I can, provided they're willing to listen. So yeah.
Right.
Well, was there a catalyst to you kind of wanting to know more, wanting to know the truth, or were you just always like that? Was there something in your life that actually happened? You said, I need to dive deeper in this.
I guess there's multiple ways to answer that, right? The simple way is, yeah, I've always had that temperament. When I was a small child, I've always been, and Omar can attest to this, I was kind of probably a weird kid looking back. I've always been a bit of a thinker. I've always been, I mean, simply put, yeah, I've always wanted to know the truth. I've always had that bug in me. Before I had the vocabulary to express that, I was always the kind of person who was like, well, why though? When I was in middle school, actually, one of my teachers gave a present to all the kids in his class after the class. Like, it was his way of saying, like, you're the most likely to do this, you're the most likely to do that. Gave one kid like a tool set because he was in the cars, like, you're going to become a mechanic. And he said, I thought long and hard about giving this, so I gave him this book. It was The Demon Haunted World by Carl Sagan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he was like, I gave this to his most likely to be a philosopher. He said, he always asked why, which is true. Everything he'd say in the class, why? So yeah, that's who I've been. As far as a catalyst though, honestly, 9/11, man. 9/11. When that happened, pretty young, but I knew, I was like, this is important. And you know, not long after that, I became about old enough to join the military in the first place. And I my knee-jerk response was to do it. At the time I was very religious, and so I thought, like, this is it, it's a battle of good and evil.
Right.
But something in me said, do not do it, because you don't understand. I started seeing just the controversy of, like, they have weapons of mass destruction, they don't. Bin Laden series, not, this is about oil, it's not. And I knew enough even then to say, like, hold up, I don't know what's going on, let me not do this. And quick little, I guess, aside, I was called a coward by, like, some of my family, some of my cousins who were around the same age were like, yeah, I'm gonna join, you fucking coward. And, you know, gotten fights and stuff over it, but here I am years later and they didn't join.
Wow. But that's amazing.
And 9/11 was a huge thing, man. And then finally the last catalyst was I read philosophy a lot, and there's a philosopher, Montaigne, who said, the ancients said to learn philosophy is to learn to live well. And then Montaigne said, I would add to that, to learn to live is to learn to die. So to learn philosophy is to learn to die well. And Montaigne was a military man himself, actually. A lot of people don't know Plato was as well. Plato was Plato's military nickname. There's a philosopher, Wittgenstein, who wrote his Logico Tractatus Philosophicus in the trenches of World War I. So a lot of my philosophical heroes were men of war and thinkers. And it all came together for me. I was like, you know, this is sort of ordained by my path as someone's into philosophy, but then also it's time. I'm old enough. I know enough. I know enough to enter this and not sacrifice who I am. And so I did it. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's absolutely incredible. I'm super stoked to hear, you know, more about your story and kind of what you do. And the big hot button right now, of course, on everyone's mind is what's happening with Donald Trump and Iran. And so you have a lot of, well, I mean, it's pretty divisive. You've got CNN saying, oh, this is a big mistake. You know, Trump is a monster. And you've got Fox over here saying, oh, well, you know, this was the right choice to make. And so, you know, as someone who's on the inside and knows more about this than any of those journalists that are just trying to get you glued to the TV, you know, what is your take on this? Like, what do you think is happening and what's going on over there?
Big question. Let me start by saying sometimes, in the same way that sometimes a good idea doesn't work and that doesn't make it a bad idea, there are times where a bad idea produces some interesting and sometimes good outcomes. That didn't make it a good idea, but it is what it is, right? I think what has happened probably is closer to the latter. It's probably fundamentally what was kind of a bad idea, but it's what's happened. And actually there's a lot of ways in which, you know, my job, I guess full disclosure, I'm an analyst, to be specific. My job is obviously to understand those sorts of things and be like, okay, well, what can come out of this? What can we make of this? What's going to be the blowback? Second, third order effects, a term we use a lot. So in a super nutshell, fundamentally, terrible idea on paper. I've worked in circles before where exactly these decisions he just made were being discussed and were suggested that he doesn't follow this course of action. And it sounds like he did. So like I said, my default position was this was a bad idea. But I also see how in certain ways the timing of this makes it work. It just might fucking work. I don't know if you guys, excuse my language, I don't know if you got a curse.
No, say whatever the fuck you want.
Yeah, it just may fucking work. If you want me to go into the whys a little bit.
I mean, maybe you could explain like exactly what's happened. So, I mean, let's set it up. Basically, mm-hmm. we know that Iran attacked an American embassy, but like, why are they even attacking American embassies or whatever? Like, what is the deal over there? Let everyone know.
Okay, so I'm going to try not to start at the true beginning because I'd be going back to, you know, 1,000 years.
Right.
All right. So Iraq is marginally a Shia majority country, mm-hmm. right? People will just say it's a Shia majority country offhand. It's actually really, really close. I forget the exact number off my head right now, but it's something like, you know, 55 to 45 Shia is Sunni. And that's not even counting all the different tribal elements that live that aren't Shia or Sunni, or the Kurds that are in the north. But let's just say, for all intents and purposes, it's by a sliver a Shia majority country. Under Saddam Hussein, the Shia were oppressed because Saddam Hussein was a Sunni overlord. And you have to understand that to understand right. Iraq, that it's a country that has a Shia majority, but that was controlled and abused by a Sunni strongman who, you know, the U.S. backed at various times and in the end obviously didn't. Right next door to Iraq, of course, you have Iran, which is the Shia majority country, the Shia powerhouse of the world, the only country in the world where the Shia have sort of unquestioned, unrivaled power. So the history of Iraq and Iran since the Iranian Revolution, 1979, has been one where I'm simplifying to a point here, but the Iranian regime under the Ayatollah has been sort of courting the Shia minority, a majority in Iraq that was at for a long time being oppressed by Saddam Hussein. So you had a lot of young men who were Shia partisans in Iraq who fought against Saddam at various times. Over the years, these guys were expelled from the country or fled the country, obviously were killed, and they fled largely into Iran. Iran, for years and years, trained them, sent them back in to do certain covert actions, but for the most part, kept them back in Iran. Fast forward, to simplify, once we took out Saddam, that was when Iran said, okay, now go, snap their finger, hatch all these guys back into Iraq. Now, this is the bad old days of the mid-2000s, right? This is 2000, let's say, 3 through about 2010. Mm-hmm. During that time, if you remember what the mainstream media was saying, and, you know, mainstream media, big buzzword, the media at large, because nobody really knew what was going on at the time, they were saying that was an insurgency. There was an Iraqi insurgency that people didn't want us
there. Right.
Okay, the fact is Iranian proxies in Iraq didn't want us there. The people of Iraq, honestly, in some ways wanted it, sometimes didn't, obviously when we, you know, did things that were really stupid and resulted in collateral damage, but for the most part, we haven't heard their opinion on the matter. The most vocal group in Iraq since the fall of Saddam Hussein has been these Iraqis who were in Iran's pocket. So that was that. And then of course you get the rise of ISIS and that changed everything. Then there's a new enemy that everyone could concentrate on, literally everybody. I guess a quick aside, in some ways, ISIS coming on the scene was an opportunity for literally every country in the world to try to realign things in the Middle East, right? Because it gave us, gave Russia, it gave Turkey, it gave Iran, it gave literally everybody a enemy that we could all say, this is why we're doing everything, because they're so dangerous, but allowed us all to sort of maneuver around that. It's like, imagine all these beasts at the watering hole and they get to say, we're here for the water, but really they're sizing each other up across the pond.
Can we pause on that for a second, Ash? Absolutely. Because isn't that just very convenient? All of a sudden now we have an actual like enemy that we can focus on and stuff, and they just popped out of nowhere. So I'm kind of like, you know me, we haven't spoken a long time, but I question a lot of things as well. And obviously I'm listening to you talk and I'm like, man, I miss this level of deep thought in the way that you articulate yourself, man. This is great. But so I'm going to ask kind of what might be considered a stupid question, but like, what is ISIS? Like, from my understanding, you can tell me how off base I might be, that basically it's just like more of mercenaries than actual like religious factions or anything like that. I heard that there's not a whole lot of religion mm-hmm. tied behind it. Basically, it's just like,
that's not entirely wrong.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. The way it is with a lot of these groups is the funny thing. I'm going to talk about ISIS, and it sounds like they're unique, but actually, you see this in the Taliban, you see it in Al Qaeda, you see it all over the place. So the hardliners that make up like this, you know, 20 something, I'm just throwing that number out there, but for the sake of an idea of proportion, let's say 20% of these guys are true dyed in the wool hardliners. They're Sunni extremists. That means they're of the same basic sect of Islam as like Al Qaeda, the Taliban. The majority of Muslims honestly are Sunni, but of course the majority of Muslims aren't violent psychos, right? So the Abandi Islam, all these different sort of more extreme sects of Sunni Islam that are more militant, more believed in violent jihad, mm-hmm. they fall into that camp of those guys. Among them, though, ISIS was even more extreme than Al Qaeda in some ways. In particular, it was their willingness to attack any Muslim who didn't believe exactly what they believed.
Right.
So the big falling out between ISIS and Al Qaeda, again, the hard lines. Your question in a second was you had Zarqawi, which was the head of, it wasn't called ISIS at the time, it was like the Mujahideen Shura Council. It had several names, but he was a young up and coming guy in the jihadist sphere. Bin Laden was like, this dude's got a lot of talent, but the difference was Bin Laden and all these guys were like, hey, we are not going to kill Shias now. That's for the future. Right now the project's to drive out the West, to attack the far enemy, as Al Qaeda calls us. Zarqawi was like, nah, bro, it's time. They know better. You, by the work you guys have done, every Muslim in the world should know this is the true Islam. And if they don't, they got a week. If they don't convert, we kill them. He was so effective that they left him in place for years in Iraq, but that actually exacerbated things in Iraq a lot. So during that same insurgency period I was talking about, these guys were looking around and they were just killing anybody. If you're American, you're dead. If you're Shia, you're dead. If you're Sunni, but you don't believe what they believe, you're dead. So Al Qaeda was like, God damn, he's good. We can't stand this kid, but man, he's beast. And that's the germ that became ISIS. We killed Zarqawi, his people, you know, the al-Baghdadis, they ended up doing certain things. And eventually that's where we get ISIS at. So that's the hardline guys. And Al Qaeda, that's that small percent, that's the core. Yes, the further out you radiate from that 20%, roughly, you know, the more you get into the guys who are essentially just mercenaries, like you said, the guys who just want money, or the guys who just want to fight, because a lot of these guys just, you know, I hate to say it, but in a lot of ways, it's not that different from any military force. You know, you got guys like me out there who want to do something, want to make a difference and want to really get at something. But then, frankly speaking, you got cats who they feel they want to make a difference, but at the same time, they just want glory. They want to fight. They want to go out there and they want that action. And it's no different for them. A lot of those guys like that. And then, of course, you got those young idiots who, you know, joined from some Western country because they think, hey, this is it. I get to play like rebel against the evil empire. And they got over there and it wasn't at all they thought it was. And they
right
and own moms.
They even had random people just decide to go there on their own, right? Like Joe from Indiana decided to get a plane ticket over there and try to go fight.
Yep, and there's it's funny. This is on the internet. This is on open source. Nothing I've said so far, you can't Google and find if you just know where to look. The problem with our age isn't that the information isn't out there. The problem is there's so much false information that the average person doesn't know how to differentiate. It's flooded. So everything I've said, honestly, you can just Google and find this stuff. There's books written on it, copious amounts of articles, there's blogs. But I say that by way of saying Joe Schmo from Indiana, there's blogs on the internet that chronicle the lives of guys like that. And almost every time Trump's like, oh my God, this is not what I thought. These ISIS guys are scary. Bring me home. Every time.
I love that voice, man.
So sad.
Yeah. Thank
you. Oh my God, see me. Happens
a lot. I like my head.
Yeah, yeah. Precisely. But yeah, to answer your question, Omar, yes, there's a sizable portion of ISIS that is effectively mercenaries. But then, like I said, honestly, that's the same as lies. The Taliban, they talk like they are like true believers. A lot of those guys are like, I'm starving. I can't feed my family. If I die, the Taliban will pay an insurance cost to my family. So I joined the Taliban. A lot of it's like that.
Can I just ask the dumb question that I think a lot of people, you know, maybe wonder, maybe some people already know. How does an organization like that even get money? I don't understand that. I actually don't. I actually just, that's a basic principle for having something, an organization that big. You know, you obviously have funding, but that's something I don't know, is how they get funding. Yeah. Do they just steal? Are they actually funded? What's going on there?
All the above, interestingly enough. So it's a little different case by case. It depends on what they have at their disposal in their particular region, obviously, right? Afghanistan, there ain't no oil. In Iraq, there is. So they're going to exploit these different things different ways. But basically, yes, both. The Taliban, for instance, they get donations from like a lot of the Gulf states. You get to like Hamas, they get donations from here in America. There's a lot of well-meaning people who will just say, okay, this is an oppressed group, send them cash. At the same time, though, that's never quite enough. So then they get into illicit deals. The Taliban has all that opium. So a lot of the opium trade in the world originates in, you know, you hear the term like Hindu Kush, things like that. I mean, that's that area. So opium, marijuana, all that stuff, a lot of that comes from there.
Lashkargah.
When you get into opium, you get to, exactly. Yeah, there you go. When you get to that area, things are super interesting because a lot of that opium starts in illicit circles in the Taliban, but it ends up in, you know, legal drugs here in the States, and the pharmaceutical industry knows that. And there's a point where they're like, hey man, you can't disturb that too much. And I don't mean that to like start some debate about big pharma being good or evil. It's like, I think it's necessary. I get it. We need that stuff to a point. And so it's not a matter of, okay, if the Taliban was not in power and there was a sympathetic Western government in Afghanistan, that opium would still be there. We still need it. So then it wouldn't be a bad thing anymore. We'd have like a legal trade with a partner. So it's just, you know, I'm saying, it's not a matter of like, oh, big pharma. It's like the fact is a huge part of the world's opium comes from there and somebody's got to get it to us. So it's like this delicate situation where it's like, that's a big part of their money. But if we disturb that, we're messing up a lot of things that, you know, people rely on.
Yeah, it gets really messy too, though, because then you have like the U.S. government, like young people going over there and basically just guarding opium fields like the whole time and then defecting and telling their story because they're like, this is not what I signed up for.
Yeah, it's a mess. This is a complicated situation, to say the least.
One of the other ways that these militant groups are funded is by the U.S. government, right?
That's maybe a slight overstatement, but at the same time, so to clarify, you go back to the beginning of the Taliban when they were fighting against the Russians, when they were, you know, the brave Mujahideen. That's not quite fair. Let me be clear. That's a sensitive one. The Mujahideen weren't necessarily the Taliban. A lot of those guys after the Soviets left were our allies and the ones who started a reasonable government. Then they started infighting. And of that infighting, the ones who succeeded were now they're the Taliban. So it wasn't all the guys back in the 70s who were fighting the Soviets. Some of them, looking back, were like really good human beings. And they were all Mujahideen. But so we funded we helped to aid the Mujahideen, some of which ended up becoming our enemies, some of which became our allies, but they're dead now. So in that way, yes, things like that. There are times where, like, let's say Lebanon, right? Lebanese Hezbollah, who's a militant organization who's against us. We give arms to the government of Lebanon, which is not aligned with Hezbollah. It's an opposition group in the country. But sometimes we can track by the serial numbers of those weapons that they end up in the hands of Hezbollah. Yemen is a good example, right? We give arms to a certain population in Yemen to fight against certain rebel groups. But then once again, we see those arms end up in them because you can't control how stuff goes. If they kill the people, we give the arms so they can take the arms. If one of those guys' cousin is one of them and he's an insider, you can give them the arms. If those arms end up on a black market because these people, to a point, are just like, fuck, I need money. I'm going to sell this stuff the Americans gave me. It come right back around. And money's the same way. You may give money to a certain group, but then they may funnel money back to the other one. Iraq, back to bring it all back around. We have the train and assist program with the Iraqi government, right? Good idea in theory, right? Train them to fight their own battles so we don't have to be there. Well, like I said, a lot of those guys were oppressed by Saddam. They joined the, they joined the army. They use those skills, and then they leave, and then they join the Shia militia groups. If you want this to be a perfect segue back into what we were talking about, they end up joining. We didn't know the whole time. They were some of those guys who escaped into Iran and were trained by Iraq. They come back in and say, hey, America's got this great program, and they give money and training and weapons to the Iraqi government. If I just join that, I got access to that, which is a huge issue right now, actually, in Iraq. So it isn't that we like say, hey, man, here's some money, go do some shit, and we're a bunch of lies. It's just complicated.
Right.
It's just, it's hard. It's impossible for me to decide what they do with the arms and the money we give them, in a nutshell.
So no, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh yeah. I was going to say, I could get back into the situation in Iraq if you guys want now.
Yeah.
So Saddam Hussein's toppled, the Shia guys come back in, we fight them. ISIS comes up. ISIS gives everybody sort of this focus. But after, in a nutshell, after ISIS was toppled, Battle of Mosul, big turning point. A lot of these Shia guys, they were instrumental in defeating ISIS with American air power. That's the thing. They used in their rhetoric to say, we fought off ISIS. But the fact is, like, it was very much a joint effort. We did a lot of heavy lifting from the air because none of them got a viable air force. And air force is king these days, dropping, you know, warheads on forays, as we said, you know, on different people. That helps immensely in urban
shit. All you need is drones now. You know,
pretty much, man. That's what I'm talking about. Hey, drones. If American drones weren't on the battlefield in Iraq in the fight versus ISIS, man, it would have been just a lot more horrible than it was. Yeah. So yeah, that's anyway.
Obama.
So the obese. Hey, people criticize his drone use a lot, but it was one of those kind of funny things where it's like, is inhumane or whatever you want to say as it sounds, that's somebody on the ground who doesn't have to be on the ground, or somebody who doesn't have to be on the ground face to face getting killed. You know what I mean? It was wild, actually. This may become a topic of our discussion, but the different morality when you get into these situations is very interesting. Yeah,
the greater good.
In a sense, I mean, I hate that term, but like something I've become fond of just seeing is like morality is different in different context. It just is. 5,000 young men over here to fight and possibly die is inherently different from the morality of a guy at a grocery store who has to be polite. I'm not impugning either one of those moralities. We need them. And civil society, I need to be polite to show you I'm not going to hurt you. I need to have certain kinds of manners. I need to do certain things. When I'm on a battlefield, that morality just doesn't make sense.
Right.
It's not the same thing anymore. And that's a very interesting thing to me. I've realized it's very interesting about humans is the lack of understanding of that from respect for that within different spheres, but then also the ability to adapt to it when it's you in that situation is something else.
You say there's a lot of gray area there then, huh?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a common term. We work in the gray, they say.
Yeah. Can we all,
I keep interrupting myself. Huh?
No, go keep ahead, going. Seth. Keep going.
Oh, okay. ISIS is gone. Okay. So after the fall of ISIS, you have tens of thousands of highly trained, now battle-hardened Shia militiamen who, once again, just to hit on the point, the mainstream media or the media in general at the time was saying these are Iraqi militias who are finally standing up for the country. This is awesome. Like I said, these weren't, yes, they were Iraqi technically, but they were Iranian agents who have been sent back to the country trained. And, you know, so now you got these tens of thousands of guys running around. They're armed, they're highly trained, they're battle hardened. You have a situation like Mosul, where if they liberated the city of Mosul, which is a Sunni majority city, and the Sunnis were like, hey man, can you leave? They were like, nah, but we're good. We're going to stay here. We like it here. So they're like, oh, what are you guys doing? It's just shady stuff like that was happening. So the Iraqi government was like, we now have all these highly trained Iranian proxies in the country. What do we do? So then they introduce a measure to control them, which is organize them into something called the Popular Mobilization Forces under a government institution called the Popular Mobilization Committee. And it made them sort of an adjunct military to the Iraqi military. And that was a way to sort of, you know, like I said, give them an element of control. The blowback from that is our agreement with the Iraqi military, the Train Assist Program, was members of the Iraqi military, they now have access to that. So we're training these guys. I trained 200 dudes. I don't know who is one of them or not, but I know they're there. And it was a mess situation. Anyway, so you ask what's happening right now in Iraq. these militia groups have had the mission the entire time of obviously taking over Iraq and pushing out the Americans, because we're, you know, a big obstacle to that. And a lot of things they've done since then have been sort of jockeying to try to put pressure on the Iraqi government to remove us or put us in situations where, you know, it's our best interest to move, yada, yada, yada. So, little actions here and there of like bombing U.S. embassies. There's a timeline that's out there on the internet right now that shows that every attack against the U.S. position by a Shia militia group in the last couple of years. And for a long time, we wouldn't talk about it because it was politically convenient to talk about the fact that, you know, this was happening, you know, for fear of starting a war with these proxies and possibly Iran. But yeah, they do these little sort of death by a thousand cut type things, you know, shoot a Katyusha rocket near us, but not hit anybody because they want to show, hey, we can't kill you. Things like that. Finally, that came to a head where one of these, you know, the other week they lobbed 30 Katyushas at a military position in Iraq, injured a bunch of Iraqi military guys, by the way, and killed one American contractor. And that has been considered the red line for a long time. If you kill an American, we're going to fuck you up. And they killed an American.
Wow.
So we fucked them up.
Do you think that was their intention?
So great question. I'm glad you asked that question. This is something that even a lot of people in my field aren't grasping. So I don't think it was their intention. I could be wrong. That's the nature of my job. But here's the way I see it. A lot of these groups, okay, so we sanctioned Iran to the point where they're almost crippled recently. You may have been aware. They haven't been able to fund a lot of these proxies, and they haven't been able to fund to a point a lot of their own internal stuff. Iran's having a whole bunch of strife internally. I don't know if you guys know that. They had to kill about 1,500 protesters inside their own country, Iranian protesters against the regime.
Wow.
In Iraq.
I didn't know that. You're saying that the Iranian government killed how many?
1,500.
About 1,500.
Good.
Yeah. 1,500 of their own people that are protesting?
Yeah, in Iran. This has been going on for a while. Iran has been having a protest every other week for the last 2 years, and nobody really talks about it because it's a totalitarian regime. This doesn't get out. Once again, you can find this on the internet. There's plenty of Iranian activists on Twitter who are constantly like, hey, look at this demonstration. Oh my God, they're killing me.
Does a place like RT report on that at all?
Nobody pays attention. Great question about RT. You know what RT is, right? Okay.
Russian television.
Good. Russia Today. Yeah. And they're pretty upfront about being Russian propaganda. Yes. Their slogan is like basically news for the West from a Russian perspective. Yeah. No, they don't. That you don't see them report on that kind of stuff in Iran a lot. They're really quick, obviously. And I get it. This isn't, once again, I didn't really say passing judgment on them. They're quick to like report our shortcomings, but that's the point. They're Russian propaganda. We do the same thing in Russia. I get it. But you know, you don't see them talk about the internals of Iran much. Honestly, right now, nobody talks about that much. You have to see it on Twitter or randomly. To their credit, you see sometimes on Fox News. Sometimes they'll call out Iran a little bit.
Did you just shout out Fox News? Man,
let me be clear. I think Fox News is a joke. And when I grew up, once you talk about catalyst for me joining the military, that's one of the main. I detested Bill O'Reilly when I was a kid. But yeah, it's one of those weird things you learn when you get into this world is like sometimes the frothing at the mouth, xenophobia and jingoism of a certain outlet, they're the only people to call out people sometimes because they're predisposed to be like, oh, our enemies, they're everywhere. We hate them all. So sometimes they'll be the ones who crack the story on like, yeah, Iran did something horrible. When, you know, CNN is trying to sort of play the cool-headed media so they may ignore something like that. It's just the nature of the beast, man. It's a mess. But yeah, no, RT won't. But continuing, yes. So Iran's not in a good way in its own country. We're sanctioned to the point where they're in pain. The middle class in that country, they know what's going on. They don't blame the U.S. They're like, hey, man, y'all want us to blame the U.S. for these sanctions? We know it's because of you. You guys are assholes. Stop doing what you're doing. The U.S. won't sanction us. So they're like, shut the fuck up. Stay in your homes. We're like, we will not. And then it's like, boom, you're dead. In Iraq, same thing. It's been a whole bunch of popular protests in Iraq against the Iranian project in Iraq. Once again, all over Twitter, you see, if you know where to look, you see this stuff. And now these people were being killed by a militia group in Iraq. They were shooting tear gas canisters into the crowd and they started aiming them at people, at their faces. And that stuff comes out at hundreds of miles per hour. It was blowing people's heads apart.
Whoa. Jesus Christ.
Whoa.
So this is the backdrop of what was going on in Iraq. Look it up. I'm not telling you anything classified. You can find this stuff on the internet. So there's all this pressure against them. So then what do? They're like, hey, man, we need to ratchet up our pressure against the U.S. We need to distract. So they launched these 30 Katyusha rockets at this military base. You asked me, was that an intention to kill an American contractor? Do you think you could shoot 30 rockets at one man? No, they just lobbed the rockets at the base. Like I said, most people were injured were Iraqi military, but they knew it was an American position. So it was trying to put pressure on, trying to stoke some sort of reaction. And that's exactly what it did. Reasonable reaction, though. You kill one of us, we're going to hurt you. So we targeted a lot of that militia's positions to degrade their ability to carry out such attacks. The militias tried to use this, oh, look, it's an attack on Iraqi sovereignty. And then they stormed the embassy. Now, interesting about that situation, if you look at pictures, a lot of those idiots are still wearing their uniforms and they're wearing their tabs from that militia. So they're trying to pawn it off as a popular thing going at the embassy, but they were clearly militiamen and their supporters. They even carried the flags of that militia group, and they were chanting the typical sort of pro-Iranian death to America chant that you don't see popular protesters in Iraq chanting. While that was happening, the people over in Tahrir Square, a few miles away, they changed their chant to, in Arabic, the people at the embassy are not with us. So their bluff kind of got called. I think they were trying to make it sort of a Benghazi-type moment. Maybe the Americans will shoot somebody. We can say, look, they killed. Nothing happened. We just exercised a reasonable amount of restraint. And then they left like, yeah, I think our message was met. But no, it was a dud. After that, things they moved super quick and got, frankly speaking, confusing for everybody. And I guess I won't go into this is where I like the details of which I can't go into. But the next thing that happened is, of course, we killed General Qasem Soleimani. I will pause right now if you have any questions, because this is where things get pretty meaty.
Yeah, let me ask you about General Soleimani, because, you know, Fox News is making him out to look like a monster, and then you've got liberal media saying that he was a revered leader.
Working for the allies, from what I've also heard at some point.
This is where things are complicated. To Fox News saying he was a monster and the liberal media saying he was a revered person, my response is, ¿por qué no los dos? Why not both?
I thought you said you didn't know more than one
language.
He
was certainly revered. What's that? Said that. I saw that on that's a meme, guys.
Was that a World War III meme?
Speaking of memes, this one.
If you haven't heard, your World War III memes are not funny. Stop posting them.
Yeah, I saw that. I think... Never mind. I won't. That was something personal, but I didn't mean to post.
No, I didn't. Everybody's free to. That's what Facebook is, and I just threw my opinion out there too. That's what.
It said like share somebody. It was like share now, and I was like, what does this button do? And I hit it, and it went to my page. I was like, no, I had to like delete it really quick, because I didn't want to get on that bandwagon. Yeah, but some of them are kind of funny. I'm not gonna lie. Anyway. Yeah. So he's obviously revered. The simplest thing is he's revered among his allies, right? Obviously, like the Iranian regime. He has been, okay, let me take a step back and talk about this man's role so you understand what I mean when I say that. The Iranian Revolution, I'm sorry, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, it's a common misnomer to call them is the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. You're like an idiot if you say it in my circles. It's the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, the IRGC. They are the Ayatollah's, like, they began as like his personal militia during the Iranian Revolution. And over time, they become this sort of secondary military power in Iran. It's a very interesting situation to have. Iran has a president. It has its own military. And then on top of that, laid over the top of that, you have the Ayatollah, the supreme leader, and his Islamic Revolutionary Guard, the IRGC. And at times that's been a weird competing sort of thing in the country, but it exists such that now that's really the main power is the Revolutionary Guard. So he was the head of a unit, a sort of subsection of the IRGC called the Quds Force. And Quds means Jerusalem. It sort of points out the Islamic nature of it. And, you know, Jerusalem is the holy city to all of them. But it's sort of a Farsi shorthand for Jerusalem, Quds. So the Quds Force, the Jerusalem Force. And the whole point of the Quds Force was to be the sort of external operations of the IRGC. They were to secure the revolution abroad. So they acted as sort of like American special forces, like to go and train opposition parties within a country to, you know, take certain actions. They also acted sort of like the CIA. They had like the degree of authority to do whatever they needed to. The Ayatollah at one point said, I give Soleimani permission to do whatever he needs to do to secure the revolution abroad. Literally, he was like, the man's carte blanche to do anything he wants. So that means that he was responsible. This is a fact. He was responsible for everything from the setting up and training of these militias in Iraq that I've been talking about, to helping to train and arm Lebanese Hezbollah in Lebanon, to doing the same thing in Syria with a lot of their militia groups and everything like that, to arming the Houthi rebels down in Yemen to fight against Saudi Arabia, and even to funneling aid to the Afghan Taliban at times. And by extension, you can see how Hezbollah has connections to the drug trade in South America, all the way through the Mexican cartels. This is the guy that, like, a lot of this was his brainchild. That's his position. So in those circles, hell yeah, he's revered. He's you know, this dude's amazing to them. And in a lot of ways, you have a lot of people in all militaries who are like, he's kind of a genius. He is an admirable guy as a patriot to his own country. We don't like him, but like, hey man, he's good what he does. And then you radiate out from that any sympathizers any of these groups have. Yeah, they're also going to think he's pretty cool. You know, they may not be actually in these groups, but anybody who has that sort of anti-West, anti-imperial perspective, they may look at him as something of a hero. On the other hand, to call him a monster, while that's obviously, that's loaded language, right? It's obviously trying to build up a certain emotional response to him. What they're talking about is everything I just said.
Dehumanify, not look like
they're trying to dehumanize the guy.
That's the word. I was like, there's a word. Words.
Omerisms.
What did I say? Dehumanify. Dehumanify. I say it's a dehumanify.
I know over there in the Middle East that they like to dehumidify.
You said yeah. It's very dehumid over there.
Very dry.
But honestly, the same thing. In short, the same evidences that you could use against him to say he's a monster are the same evidences by which other people admire him. You know. I will say this, though, and I feel this is incumbent on me to say. For people in the United States, understand this. The enemy of my enemy is not always my friend. If you consider like Trump to be your enemy, right? Because he's Trump. That doesn't mean that just because somebody doesn't like somebody, that makes them somebody you should sympathize with. Sometimes the enemy of your enemy is just another war criminal. And that's the case in Qasem Soleimani. Like, if you don't approve things we've done, you can't approve it. It's hypocritical to approve things he's done because he's done the same thing for someone else.
Right.
And a lot of times these things are things that have resulted in the deaths of our sons and daughters as Americans or someone else's as Sunni Iraqis. Like I said, he's the man. So I said they start shooting people in the face, those gas cans. He said, you can do that. He used it. I forget the term Shia Islam, and Sunni Islam is termed Sunni extremist circles are the term takfir. And that means like they're not a real Muslim. So it's basically what they say, you can kill them if you want to.
Wow.
Shias have a similar, like extremist Shias have a similar term. I forget what it is, but he said that. He said, these protesters are that. They're not real Muslims. So go ahead and kill them. And they started killing them. So no, this is not a good person. You know, so don't get that twisted. I mean, if you're going to use the morality to impugn what we do on those lines, you have to do the same thing then. So this is a case where the enemy of my enemy is just another war criminal. He's just a bastard. So that's Qasem Soleimani. That's who we killed. Now, for a long time, the idea of killing him was obviously out there, but nobody did it because, well, we're seeing it, this potential second, third order effects, you know. So a lot of times it was a matter of just sort of trying to combat the effects of what he was doing. And I think that's a large part of why he was killed, because he, like most other people, myself included, was like, they won't hit him. You won't do it. So he's driving around in Iraq and, you know, full view. And then, Trump is the kind of motherfucker to do it. So
bye-bye.
Here we are. Yeah.
Jesus.
So that's basically what happened. So obviously after he was killed, that's what things are super complicated. You have all the militia groups in Iraq who are like blood for blood. And you have the Iranians who are like blood for blood. But then there's a lot of practical things in the way. Like, can they actually wage war with America right now? Can they afford it? Like I said, they've been sanctioned to the point where they're on their heels. They have a ton of civil unrest at home. There's a ton of civil unrest in Iraq. Can they actually fight a war? No. So World War III, just to nip that in the bud, and can be no World War III.
Yeah, I didn't think so. I've heard that Iran doesn't even have like nuclear power, really.
I can't talk about that.
Damn. I was hoping to drag it out of you.
About that. But
is that close?
Yeah.
About to break it open on News for News, man.
I know, right?
Use your own logic on that one, right? Like, I will ask you this. If they had a nuclear bomb and the point is a deterrent, don't you think they'd be waving it around to say, hey, don't come over here because we can nuke you?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. I mean, they've never really done like a, you know, a showing of that or anything like North Korea tries to do.
Yeah. Everybody thinks that's the main point of a nuke is a deterrent. When you have one, you advertise it so people don't fuck with you.
Right.
So just like I said, use your own logic on that one.
Well, we've been having this conversation. Something just came across my phone. States Iraq's parliament calls for expulsion of U.S. troops from the country following drone attack. And that happened today. Mm-hmm. So they were getting kicked out of Iraq.
No, we're not. So we are there by the invitation. We're there by the invitation of their executive branch. Okay. Right? So their prime minister has the end say of that. I'm sorry. That was an overstatement. We still may be. Yes, you're right. But them saying them having that vote, that was sort of symbolic.
Okay.
It's saying, hey, we want them out, kick them out. So now it's up to the PM. Is he going to listen to the Shia majority parliament that actually voted in the absence of the Sunni and the Kurdish contingent parliament? They actually abstained from the vote as a protest because they were like, this is bullshit. You guys are Iranian proxies. That's the degree to which Iran has infiltrated that government.
Okay.
The majority bloc is many of, literally a lot of the guys we were fighting from 2003 on are now politicians and they're in the Iraqi parliament. So it was and as some people see it as a sham vote. It was like, obviously you're going to say that. So now it's up to the PM to either toe the line or say, you know what? American sustain. If he does that, he may die. But I mean, that's the situation right now. But it's a bit more complicated than a headline makes it seem, is what I mean to say to you, Seth. Uh-huh. I didn't mean to just be like, no, you're wrong. But yeah, that's.
Well, don't forget, Seth, you're also a big consumer of fake news.
I don't agree.
An inside joke.
I don't agree with that. I mean, I guess if we're going by Trump standards, yes, that's fake news.
Oh, CNN.
Yeah, I do a lot of CNN. But anyways,
yeah.
Ash, can I ask you what you prefer to consume for news? So our listeners can maybe get a more unbiased approach if they don't already have one.
Ooh, wow. And I want to know who you're voting for 2022. That's what I want to know also. So, what news do you listen to, and then who are you voting for?
News is complicated, right? So I have this, once again, my particular function in this community that I work in is to know as much about everything as I can. So I honestly, I consume all news. I look at everything.
But you prefer Infowars.com, right?
Yeah, Alex Jones, my shit.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Ash. Appreciate it.
I tell my permission. But listen, watch is the wrong term. I don't have time to watch anything. I will say this, honestly, people at large, if you have time, the best way to consume information is not to watch. Literally, if you just like time out a documentary, in 2 hours, they get as much information as the cheat flaps of a book. Mm. Right? So reading is the most powerful way. It's dense. And for the amount of time you put into it, you learn so much more. Anyway, my little plug for libraries. but yeah, to answer your question, like I said, in general, I consume a lot of everything. And a lot of what I do is try to look at primary sources. So that's a strategy I have is like, if Fox News says something, I say, where did you get that? That's right. The trick. If CNN says something, I say, where did you get that? And then you have to become very sensitive to, like I said, the biases of a certain outlet, right? So like, I know Fox, like I said, I know they're going to be on high alert for any threat because one of the fundamentals of any kind of conservative perspective is security.
Fear.
And stability. And, you know, yeah, and security is linked very closely to fear. Exactly. So they're going to be our enemies everywhere at all times. So you just have to understand that. There are times, like I said, they're going to call out exactly what they should call out. It's like, okay, hey, man, because they're predisposed to think that way. But there are times where they're going to say some shit. I'm like, y'all turn it up a little. And on the other hand, somebody like CNN, they're going to try to espouse a certain middle of the road perspective. So a lot of times they're going to try to play down things, like I said, the role of Qasem Soleimani, because they don't want to be seen as towing that line of saying, yeah, he was a monster. So you have to be aware of the biases, but I think I'm not really answering the heart of your question. You're really, Andy, it's who I prefer, right? That's what you're kind of getting at. You want me to talk about politics there? Is that what kind of?
Sure, why not?
Leaning towards?
Libertarian, I assume?
well, this is where things get interesting. So my ideal, I'm
Tulsi 2020.
Kind of an anarchist, really.
Oh, wow.
I like what... Henry David Thoreau said, he was quoting, I think, one of the founding fathers, and he flipped the quote, the government which governs best is that which governs not at all. And when men are ready for it, they shall have such a government. So that's my ideal. But here's the thing, we're not ready for that government. We ain't ready for that.
Right.
And I totally see that. So when I take a step back from that, I think of what's called left libertarianism is what I start to kind of like. So libertarian being the idea of obviously, yeah, I'm okay, you're okay, you can do whatever you want to the degree that doesn't hurt somebody else. Yes. In a nutshell, right? Kind of libertarianism.
Yeah.
But in the States, we talk about libertarianism, it's something right libertarianism. You know, we tend to think of people who are libertarian or right lean. In America, libertarianism is essentially
it's like right light. You
know, for like these sort of exactly. That's exactly, I would agree completely.
Yeah.
But we understand that, yeah, that's there's a such thing as a left libertarian. And it's like the idea of like the same basic ideas of like freedom, like, hey, do what you want as long as you hurt somebody else, with this added caveat that we do think it's incumbent on whatever government we have to try to ensure some sense of equity among the people. Yeah, I guess we should have something, a safety net, some welfare programs, some things to kind of help people out a little bit.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of times right libertarians will be like, oh, why am I paying for this other person's Medicare? It's like, because they can't fucking afford it. And they're a poor single mother and made some bad decisions. But if you were down and out, you'd want some help. So, you know, pay $5 a year to help this lady out. Jesus Christ. Be a human. speaking like personal experience here, I mean, like you can look at this and say, okay, well, you're saying it because he's biased, whatever. Like, I grew up with government assistance. I was very poor when I was a kid. Like, people don't understand how poor you can be in America, and not telling my life story. They're like, what the fuck? I'm like, yeah, man. Like, I'm talking like water turned off, sewage in front of the house, nobody picking up the garbage because that part of the state doesn't get services. Like, it was bad. And like, I wouldn't be who I was if my family didn't get help from the government. So I see how that can work, and not in like the way a lot of right wing people say it enables all this laziness. No, my mom was over and over. My mom, you remember my mom?
Yeah.
Very hardworking, brilliant woman. We needed assistance. She made some bad decisions in life, but that doesn't mean she was a bad person or lazy. She was taking care of me, my little sister, my brother, and seven of my little cousins, working full time. Fuck out of here. Like, she needed help. We got help. And I wouldn't be who I was if we didn't get that. It enabled me to not stress out being a homeless teenager at one point, a homeless child at one point. That it enabled me to be able to concentrate enough to actually develop into the person I am. And I have to, you know, go to some whatever kind of lifestyle I have to go into to live the life I wanted. You see my point? So anyway, left libertarianism. Yes, give people freedom, but you need to help people out.
I think but that's even an that incredibly is, think, powerful story that you just shared. I mean, that's a lot of people that will listen to this probably fall, you know, in a libertarian mindset, or, you know, maybe they're not set on one specific path, but whenever a libertarian hears your story and says, man, people do need help, like, that's going to challenge them and their beliefs. Like, there's no reason why you have to be so black and white with your politics. It's like, there are people that actually need help, so something has to be done, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but no, I really appreciate your story there.
I meant that as an aside, but you're a good point. That right there could be a podcast in itself. That's, yeah, it
absolutely
counts people's politics in that way. I guess one more button on that, if you want to think of it in a prudent sort of Ayn Randian sort of selfish way, if you help the poor, they're less likely to rob you, to revolt, to vote against your interests. Like, give people a reason to not agitate. Yeah, it's that simple. So, like, yeah,
you subdue the masses.
Hey, man, yeah, in a way, yeah, give them a. Oh God, what did the Romans say? Anyway, yeah, give them a little butter so they're happy. You know.
Mm-hmm. You know. Now going into 2020, obviously you obviously just described your political leanings, and I would say almost no candidate represents that perfectly. But no. Who? I don't know. It seems weird that Joe Biden's the guy that people are, you know, the media is kind of choosing.
Creepy Joe Biden.
Wouldn't even let him watch my kids.
No, God, no.
Much less the nation.
Wash or watch? Because I wouldn't let him wash my kids either. What'd you say?
Both, neither one.
Okay. Would you with
They'd
Trump?
Be playing with his leg hair if he washed them.
I'm sorry, Andy. What were you finished with your question?
Well, just
is there a question there?
From the candidates that you've seen, who would you most likely cast your vote for, and who do you wish was running?
All right. I'm going to tactically refrain from answering that to a point.
Okay,
nice.
Now, I'm going to be honest, and I'm a little ashamed to admit this. My job is such that right now I haven't been able to keep on domestic politics as well as I can, which is funny because I'm sitting there thinking compared to the average American, yeah, I'm probably still far more informed. But, like, I'm not as informed as I want to be right now on a lot of these candidates. My gut tells me, though, in a lot of ways, we're repeating the same mistakes we did last time. The Democrats, the media is sort of trying to put its power behind what they think is the safe bet, Joe mm-hmm. Biden, but it's not the bet that captures anybody's imagination. The last election, if you ask me, it was clearly going to be a populist who was going to win. It's going to be Bernie Sanders or yep. Trump.
That's right. Obviously. And Bernie would have beat Trump.
And Bernie probably would have beat him because there are more. I forget the exact numbers. Once again, please fact check me, look it up. Anybody's listening. But like, if I recall correctly, during your average election year, it's something like about 20% of people don't vote. During that election, that almost doubled. It was like in the 30s that didn't vote. Those people who didn't vote, I'm pretty sure from, you know, sort of anecdotal like experience, like meeting people, those aren't people who were gonna vote for, you know, some Republican and didn't. Those people were gonna vote for Bernie and didn't. Right. They were like, you know what, fuck it, they're gonna fuck over my vote not at all. Which I would say, you know, that's on their head too. Then if they don't like this guy and he won, you should have compromised and voted for Hillary if that's what you really wanted. But yeah, that's the case. So I think we may see a repeat of that where people are like, there's no populist. Now we can get into that too. I don't think populists are a good idea all the time. Like, Jesus Christ. I think we're frothing at the mouth for people want that feeling that they have a one-to-one relationship with the democracy of this country. It's not representing democracy. Somebody's going to help them directly. Like, is that even what we want? That's an aside. But yeah, anyway, I think we're still in that fervor. We still want to pop. I think people on the left want somebody who's going to make people on the right. And there's nobody that caps that imagination right now. Meanwhile, people on the right, they're getting that out of Trump. He's sticking to the libs. So, you know.
He really is. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny that you brought up Hillary because I was watching some old debate stuff the other day about Iran. And Mike Gravel, who's a senator or was a senator, calls her out on stage for voting to go to war with Iran that very day. So, you know, even if Trump hadn't been in office, I bet Hillary probably would have, you know, already tried to go to war with Iran anyway. So I think this is probably inevitable. What do you think?
Oh, that's a really good hypothetical.
Super hypothetical, but I mean, you know, she was war hungry to go, you know.
I think, and this is actually, once again, everywhere about my politics, one of the things. Okay, so when I do vote, I've always had this perspective of this. A lot of the domestic stuff that Americans get super caught up on is going to take care of itself, right? Because a lot of stuff isn't even decided by the president, unless he's going to start doing what the president shouldn't do and trying to direct a lot of domestic policy. That's a lot of that's judicial and legislative branch. Mm-hmm. A lot of that's local government. So when I look at a president, one of the first things I ask myself is how many people are going to die as a result of this person's actions? What's the net loss of life, period? Not even just American, period. How many people are going to die? And I tend to think of things that way when I look at presidents, right? So like I look at, let's say, a president who his foreign policy seems to be built around a very, maybe neocon perspective. And he's going to favor large scale military actions. That's going to have a larger net of lost life. And then I look at somebody who maybe follows a more, the way the neoliberals tend to do things, the way Obama do things, right? They're going to use drone strikes. It's going to be very precise, very surgical. It's going to be, the intentions are the same effects, but you're going to see a less loss of life for everybody, for us and our enemies. So I think Hillary Clinton fell into that latter camp. I think she would have obviously been antagonistic towards Iran, but I don't see how we continue to do the type of things on strikes to try to put pressure on. Could that have resulted in war? Yeah, but I don't think it would have been nearly as flagrant. And so I guess I'm saying probably, but less likely will we've actually gone to all war with Iran. And like I said, once again, hey man, I don't think we're going to war with Iran. They know they can't. They don't want this smoke. To put it shortly, they can't handle a fallout war with this.
Okay, so I'm looking here and I'm seeing some issues with timing. Okay. So like Hillary may have been for that, in which case this wouldn't have probably happened at the end of her third term. Third year, whatever, coming up on an election. In fact, Donald Trump has tweets from 2012 in which he's attacking Barack Obama, saying that he's going to declare war on Iran so that he can stay in office another 4 years. And here we are, another distraction. And I'm just saying the timing looks very different. Like,
I see that.
One, with Hillary, with your point here, Chris, that's a policy standpoint. I don't think that Trump is operating out of policy. I think he's operating out of reaction. And I
think Trump is reacting out of however he fucking feels that day.
Well, yeah.
I don't think he has any rhyme or reason for a lot of the things he does, but that doesn't change the fact that Hillary Clinton is a warmongering, you know, crazy woman.
But she's also
who would have been horrible in office.
But she's also not in office. So
yeah, but
I mean,
that's why we need Gary Johnson. Gary Johnson.
So I mean, why am I talking about a hypothetical when this is really happening? Because
everyone thinks that Trump is the only one that would do this, or that Trump is the only one that wants, you know, to go and start a war or whatever.
Probably at the end of his term, when he's terrified that he's going to be kicked out of office or no longer.
He's not terrified. He knows for a fact he'll be back in office. No, have you looked at the Democratic candidates? There's no fucking way he doesn't take office. And he knows it.
His Twitter speaks against that. His Twitter speaks like he's constantly nervous. He's complaining about everything every day.
All right. Anyway, boys,
sorry.
You guys can argue
sorry,
about
Ash.
This later.
I apologize, Ash. The timing looks... I don't like it.
I mean, that's one of those things that like I'm not going to really super get into, but like I would say use your logic. Yeah, it's interesting, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I see that. Once again, it goes back to the first thing I said, though, right? Sometimes a bad idea, it may work out, but that doesn't mean it was a good idea. You know, it could be that we, in a very pie in the sky sort of situation, we could have just pulled the Ayatollah's bitch card hardcore. They may not be able to really do any meaningful response to what we've done, and it could show how weak they are. And then we may see the end of what is a totalitarian, horrible regime in the country. That doesn't mean this was a good idea. That doesn't mean, like, to your point, Seth, that like this wasn't real convenient timing, but like it just may work out. Maybe, yeah, that's
it. Do you think that that's the likely end goal of all of this, is that Iran gets to topple the totalitarianism?
It's a possible end goal. Likely, I don't say. Are y'all up on estimative language? Do y'all know what that is?
I'm not familiar.
I have no idea.
You'll notice that I say things like impossible. A lot. It's a thing in the intelligence community. You get assessments. There's technically speaking doctrinal terms used, and they mean precise percentages. So if you say likely impossible, I'm sort of trained to think in these percentages. So excuse me if I use these terms, and I guess your viewers should understand when I say likely, I mean about 70%.
Okay.
You know, I mean, when I say possible, I mean I'm not assigning a percentage. I'm saying it's on the table, though. It's not impossible. It's like these things I just realized, like I'm using those terms. I'm like, I should probably be clear here. I'm using them very precisely. So it's very possible that could happen. I don't know. I'm not prepared to say how likely it is.
Gotcha.
And who do you wish was running? It's early.
How many different
up,
ways
I
can
I
we ask this question?
Who do you wish was running? Like, who would be your ideal presidential candidate?
Joe Rogan.
I mean, if you're saying like you want me to talk about a personality who's in the world, who I'm like that person.
Sure.
Yeah.
Stephen Colbert. Yeah.
I don't have anybody.
Okay.
Seriously, there's nobody I'd say is an ideal candidate at all.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I think the idea of the president's stupid.
Yeah.
Well, that's a different discussion, I guess.
Yeah, it is.
And that's sort of the nature of my beliefs in politics on things. Sometimes I don't know if there'd be anybody who'd be exactly what I want to see. Just once you get to the type of person who'd say I'm going to run for president is probably not the type of person I want to be president.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, if you're going for the power, yeah, you probably don't need it.
Yeah. I can't imagine that person. It would be some
megalomaniac.
Well, they're bred from birth pretty much at this point, you know, to be president. So it's,
you ain't lying, man. Yeah. These people are groomed. Yeah.
And you have to pretty much from a young age, like learn to, you know, ignore everything that you think is right and try to just be popular. And it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's wild. Even Obama, who, when he was president, I was critical, but since I've joined the military, I've come to weirdly respect. Like, you would maybe surprise to hear that certain thing. I was like, looking back, I was like, damn, I was actually really smart, but people didn't get it. But even him, you're right. Like, there's times where I think about it, I'm like, who the fuck do you think he was? You think he'd be president? Who says that? I'm going to be the leader of the free. I'm going to be the most powerful man in the world one day. What? Like, yeah, it's.
Yeah, it takes a certain person, you know, to be able to maybe it's egotistical person to say,
oh, yes,
I've got the right answer for the entire population.
Yeah, absolutely.
I call it a mental health disorder called narcissistic personality disorder.
I bet that every president has that.
You pretty much have to. Well, yeah. Oh, Ash, this has been a pleasure. You got another question.
I've got one
Chris.
More question. Okay. Just one more question, if you don't
better
mind.
Better be a good one.
I hope so. So, Ash, as someone who grew up in poverty, who, you know, wasn't afforded the privilege that others are in this world to start out with, you know, more than what you had, why even go and fight for the country? You know, you already said you're kind of an anarchist, so you don't necessarily even believe in the system. The system didn't do you any favors as a youngster, you know, so why is it that you feel like you want to go and fight for that?
Good question. So y'all see the movie Seven?
We just
talked about
in our movies that molded me. It's going to be released this weekend.
Oh, that's spectacular. What a wonderful segue. So there's that line at the end of the movie where Morgan Freeman's
what's
like,
in the box?
Well, there's that line too, yeah. There's a line where Morgan Freeman, he's like, Ernest Hemingway once said, the world is a fine place and worth fighting for. Mm. I agree with the second part. Like, yeah, the world is a fine place and worth fighting for. I agree with the second part. The world is a horrible place in a lot of metrics, but it's worth fighting for because it's all we have. America, by some metrics, is not that great, right? For some people, like to your point, like if anybody got the shaft in this, it's people who grew up like I did. But it's all we got. And I don't mean that in like a damn, this is the only country I know. I've been around the world. Like, I mean, I'm going to say this and people are going to take it some kind of funny way. It is what it is though. As fucked up as things are in this country sometimes, and as fucked up as they are in this world, this is the best we've done as humans so far. And it's I say that fully understanding all the implications of it. Like I said, you've had slavery, you've had, you know, people, you've had people. It's horrible at times. I get it. I've lived it. I'm from that. But go somewhere else.
That
sounds
it,
like a conservative like talking point. Oh, go live over there. But like, there's a point at which I'm sorry, that's kind of true. And like, I don't mean that in a, so shut up and stop complaining. Here's why I straddle the line on that. Activists have a place here in this country. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I talk about the left libertarian thing. There's things that need to be fixed and that's their work to do it. The only problem with them is when they take what should be sort of domestic pressures and then they look out into other spheres and think they know what they're talking about. Kind of like we're talking about this guy, Soleimani. You have people like, what's his name? Colin Kaepernick released some statement on Twitter condemning what we've done against Qasem Soleimani and like, oh, it's typical America. I'm not surprised they do this because they typically exploit brown people. And it's like, you realize that brown person would kill you in a heartbeat. Like,
right.
This is not worth. You have a place, Colin. I support.
Does he have a place though? Is he still around? Is he still relevant?
Well, no,
he's not. How to throw a football?
He's not all that relevant, no. But I mean, the point is like his original take a knee thing, I supported
hell yeah.
It, honestly.
Hell yeah, me
well,
too.
I
supported that. I got what he was doing.
100%.
When it comes to like making important political life decisions, I always like to go off of the voices of prior athletes. I feel like they just have, you know, they're cued in on all
and
the
celebrity
all
or movie flags. Stars. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Really, they're the most important opinions.
But you see what I'm saying, though, right? Like, as an activist, he had a point. He made it. It was good. But when he takes that perspective and tries to apply it to everything, that's when he starts looking like an idiot. And that's the problem.
To national security. So that's too far.
Yeah. So that's I would fight for this country to answer your question because I do think in a lot of ways the future of a humanity that can maybe someday get on a spaceship and colonize another planet, the humanity of the humanity that can create gene therapy that can cure birth defects, things like that, all these beautiful things that we want to see in the future, I don't see the Taliban working towards that. You know
no,
I mean? And I don't. I doubt Putin's going to pull that off. That's frankly speaking, for all the horrible things we've done, that's best the germ, the egg that could blossom into that is here. So I want to protect that.
That's a great, great fucking answer, man.
Dude, Ash, just hearing your voice again and talking with you just reminds me once again, like, how much I valued our relationship and how much I miss just these type of conversations. The levels that you just peel things back with ease. Also, like, I appreciate you taking the time, to speak with us and breaking things down to where, like, I came into this conversation knowing little to nothing. And I feel slightly more, like, informed. And so I really appreciate that a whole lot. And thanks for being willing to share and being vulnerable with your story. And honestly, I would love to have you back on sometime to discuss something else.
Same.
Or just honestly just hear your story some more, because I think you have a really powerful story. I know a lot about it, and I'd love for the listeners to get a chance to hear that. So
sure.
If you've enjoyed this conversation, I want to let you know that there are a few ways to get involved in our community and learn more about us. We're active on Facebook as well as Instagram. For those who support us at $5 a month, you can check us out on Marco Polo, where you can talk with not only our listeners, but also the cast, as well as the people we interview. So there's further conversation that often happens there. We've got a website, fadedegraypodcast.com, where you can, of course, find the infamous merchandise like the Poor Seth mugs, as well as the Findlay Fade to Gray hats, which honestly are pretty cool. So there are ways of learning about us there. And again, I just want to say thank you so much for listening to this episode and checking us out. We really appreciate you looking into us as we really try to put out quality content on the reg. And then also, I just want to give a big shout out to Omar Williams for editing this episode. And then also, the intro and outro music is by the wonderful Dan Koch, who has his own website and following. Be sure to check him out. And with that, stay classy.